was wondering if the Rome could tell us, in medieval Europe, in Stuart England, and later on in Salem, there were many witch trials, and the world seemed to be quite obsessed with witches. In South Africa, where I come from, it's still a problem. But I was wondering, you know, what the Gedolim of the time said about these witch trials and this obsession with witches, and whether or not we ever had a similar sort of dispensation going on in the Jewish world.
Well, you know, the Torah says in Parshas Mishpatim, Machasheka lo sechaya, that a witch is put to death. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that that it was Shimon ben Shetach executed 80 witches in Ashkelon in one day. And the Gemara even says that normally you're not supposed to kill more than one person. Dinei nefeshes of a Sanhedrin can only be one person per day, but this was such an unusually lawless situation. So, number one, the Torah clearly does tell us that there is such a thing as black magic. Now, that's not to say that witches had access to it, but some witches did. And Satan worship and being connected to the powers of impurity, there is such a phenomenon. Although, as I say, they say in the name of the Vilna Gaon that Bizman HaZeh, that does not exist. Bizman HaZeh, all so-called magic is fake, it's an illusion, it's not emes. So you don't have to worry about it today. But there was such a phenomenon. Now, whether there were any rabbis who commented on the witch trials in Europe, that I don't know. I think it would be a little dangerous because, you know, Jews themselves were often accused of being involved in these things. I think their inclination was, let's stay out of it. We don't want to encourage the hunting down of witches because they'll turn it against us in blood libels and everything else. But that there was such a thing, for sure that's the case. Now, I have to just tell you one little story about this. You know, one of the ways in the Salem witch trials that they would determine whether a woman was guilty or not is they would tie a rock to her leg and they would throw her in the water. A witch apparently had the ability to float even if there was a great weight attached to her. So the idea was that if she drowned, that proved she was innocent. If, on the other hand, she floated, that proved she was guilty and she was killed. So it's kind of a no-win situation because you're only exonerated if you're innocent. It reminds me very, the reason I bring it up is it actually reminds me of a halacha. It's obvious there's a halacha that says the same way, that the animal doesn't get a break. You know, the Shulchan Aruch says, if an animal falls off a wall, even if it didn't die, we're choshesh that its skeleton got dislocated, and because of the skeletal dislocation, it is called a trefa. So even if you shecht it, you would not be allowed to eat it because it's considered to be malformed and incapable of living. But the halacha is you can test if the animal is a trefa by putting it in water and seeing if it swims. If the animal swims, that shows its skeleton is intact, so you can shecht it. If it drowns, that shows it was a trefa that we shouldn't shecht it. So it's mamish to say, it always reminds me of the witch trial. Now, derech klal, though, one other little thing from that story, that's an interesting musar. The Shulchan Aruch says, and the Chari, this is Pashat, that swimming can show health only if the animal swims against the current. If it simply goes with the current, that proves nothing, because even dead animals can be carried with the current. That's Shulchan Aruch. So the Bali Musar say there's an important Musar there. And the Musar is, if all you're doing is following what everybody else does, then that doesn't mean you're spiritually alive. Even a dead fish will be carried with the current. That the sign of spiritual vibrancy is you're willing to buck the trend. Now, I don't mean to say in yeshiva you should buck the trend, pekeret, there you really should try to do it, the mores of the yeshiva, but when you go out to the secular world and there's so many Jews and so many people who don't keep Hashem's law, don't believe in Hashem, and it's so easy to go along with it, but the sign of being spiritually alive is that you simply don't do what everybody else does, you have the strength to be independent. So that's another muster we get from that. Yeah.
Is there any issue with Netanyahu speaking in Congress halakhically, and also in a similar vein, pro-Israel lobby in the U.S. Has a very strong pull, and is that something that Jews should continue kind of throwing their weight around to kind of influence American politics, or should Jews in America sort of have a more passive attitude and be grateful and still, you know, and ask for, I guess, support that way.
Yeah, so I assume that your first question is kind of connected to your second question, because there is no intrinsic halachic problem with Netanyahu speaking. I mean, he is warning the United States of a... First of all, he was invited. He didn't impose himself. And he is warning the United States of a grave, grave danger to the world, and he makes a lot of sense. And Baruch Hashem, although Netanyahu is not... the Tzadik Hador, and we're not going to make him Rosh Hashiva or anything. But, you know, I think he does represent the state of Israel in a pretty good way, and I think we can derive a certain pride that he is able to articulate the case against Iran in a very, very convincing way. He might be, as it were, I'm not, obviously, I mean, most of you are not voters anyway, but, you know, it's not an issue of who to vote for. Obviously, the Gedolim want us to vote for have more of a Torah representation in the Knesset. But in terms of Rosh HaMimshalah, I mean, he seems to be the best person. But the issue generally of how involved Jews should get in the political system, should they have a high profile, a low profile, it's very interesting. The Kli Yochor says, you know, if you look in Parshas Devarim, you know, the Kli Yochor lived in the Middle Ages. He lived in, or no, not the Middle Ages, the Renaissance, the 1500s. And he lived in Prague. Kli Yochor, in fact, took over from the Maharal. The Maharal was the Rav of Prague. Maharal of Prague died, and the successor was the famous Kli Yochor, who wrote beautiful, beautiful Perushim on Chumash. And as you know, if you've learned the Kli Yochor, Kli Yochor was one of the great Darshanim of the generation. So he often will bring out from the Chumash ideas that were very contemporary for his time that would also apply to our time. So in Sefer Devarim, after the Jews were encamped for a long time, there's a pasuk that says, "Panu lachem tzfona," turn and go north, just travel, time to go. But the Kli Yochor points out that tzfona has a double meaning. Tzfon means north, but tzfon also means concealment, hiddenness. For example, during the Seder, coming up to the Seder, the eating of the ceremony where we eat the afikoman is called Tzafun, eat the hidden matzah, the matzah that had been hidden previously. And the Kli Yochor says that merumas in the statement, Panu lachem tzfona, is that a Jew that lives in the Gullah should not have a high profile. Don't be ostentatious, don't call attention to yourself or to your people, because that invites jealousy, that invites ayin hara, that invites anti-Semitism. It is much better for a Jew to have a low profile, not to complain, not to rock the boat. Now, we're talking about in Chutzlaritz, obviously, because that way you don't incite the Umos HaOlam. And the Kli Yochor then goes on and says, therefore, he has a big complaint about Jews that have big houses in the Gullus and a lot of money, and as a result, the Goyim hate you and jealous, and they talk about Jewish money and Jewish power and Jewish influence and everything else. And in fact, in Prague, actually even before the Kli Yochor, from the time of the Maharal, there were various laws. I mean, takanos of the Kehillah, I mean, you know, local communal takanos that the Maharal approved of, in which Jews were not allowed to wear fancy clothing. They were not allowed to make elaborate weddings or bar mitzvahs. There was even like rules that you're only allowed to have one course. You can't have, you know, you can have fish or meat. You can't have fish and meat, etc. These are called, actually there's a term for these are called anti-sumptuary laws, laws against excessive consumption. And there were two reasons for these laws. One was not to bankrupt Jewish people who couldn't afford it. By the way, that's very nogea even today. It's a big issue. But the second was not to incite the jealousy and animosity of the Umos HaOlam. There's even a medrash that says, the Ramban brings, that it was wrong for Yaakov Avinu, when he comes back to Eretz Yisrael, to send Esav all of these gifts. Because by showing how wealthy he became, that would make Esav jealous and the like. So certainly there is a theme that you find, again in different places, that it is better for a Jew in Golos to be very, very low profile and not... be aggressive, because that creates hatred and animosity among the Umos HaOlam. Right? So that would be an argument against AIPAC and the like. The counter-argument is, of course, again, this depends if you accept this, well, America is different than Europe, right? And again, this is going to be a big machlokas. In Europe, you have the hatreds, the anti-Semitism, you have the burning of Jews at the stake. America is democratic. In a democratic country, different voices are entitled to be heard. So this, I cannot give you a clear hachra, meaning different people will say different things. There are people that say, America is different. America is different. Others that say, what do you mean? It's just a variation. We're still in Golus, and until we have the final Geula, we cannot assume any cheskas kashrus. Again, I mean, we obey the law and we behave with derech eretz, but we can't assume any particular love. And if anything, I have to say that with the current president and the like, perhaps we're beginning. Perhaps we're learning that America may not be fundamentally different. Meaning to say, here you have a guy in the White House who has no. Again, I'm not saying he's anti-Semite. I'm not saying that at all. But the one thing I think that can be said, and I'm very confident in saying it, is he has no particular love, affection, or regard for either Eretz Yisrael or the Jewish people. He looks at the Middle East as, two equal sides. They have their side, they have their side, and I got to be a fair person to adjudicate among people that are morally equivalent. Again, not anti-Semitism, this is just the hashkafa that this person has. So one of the lessons that we're absorbing is that, we thought America was different, maybe it's not so different. So I can tell you that there is a marker in the Kli Yoker and in the Ramban that Jews should have a lower profile in political life. You may remember, you guys were very young then, but you may remember Senator Joseph Lieberman, who was the senator of Connecticut, and he actually was on the vice presidential campaign, and he was a Shomer Shabbat, not only a Jew, the first Jew in those running for that office, but also an Orthodox Jew, a Shomer Shabbos Jew. He wasn't Haredi in the sense, obviously. But he was, he was committed to be a Shomer Shabbos. He davened every day, put on tefillin every day, kept kosher. And there were so on one hand, some people were so excited, Baruch Hashem, we have a Jew, who's made it in the highest echelons of power. But others said, no, Penu Lechem Tzvayim, maybe it's not so good to have a Jew in those highest positions and the like. So your point is a well taken, is a good point. Yeah.
Why does the Gemara start with Daf Bet and not
Okay. So there's the real reason, and then we like to give inspirational reasons. The real reason is that in the Jewish printing houses, the cover page was Daf Aleph. That's just the way they numbered it. In other words, when they ordered the papers, even though they didn't put a one on it, page one was the cover. In other words, I don't mean the hardcover, but the cover with the picture and everything. And then that's the real reason. Now, the inspirational reason, because we like to read all sorts of deep reasons into things, is that a person has to know that Torah is so deep that you haven't even really begun it. You can drop yourself in the middle, so to speak, but you haven't even started page one. That even when I'm learning, millions of pages of Gemara in my life, let's say, I haven't even started the Aleph. And then they point out as well that there is a nice remez that the Chumash itself begins with Beis, right? Bereishis Bara Elokim, and in a way, it's a way of connecting the written Torah and the oral Torah. So those are reasons, but the real reason is that's just the convention of the printers. Yeah.
What are the differences between the Palestinian and Babylonian Talmud, and why is the Babylonian Talmud the one that's all the emphasis?
Oh, wow, you're asking such simple questions tonight. Well, this is a vast thing. We have two Gemara, right? It's all the same Mishnah, right? The Mishnah. And then we have two different Gemaras. We have the Talmud Yerushalmi and we have the Talmud Bavli. What is interesting is the Talmud Yerushalmi was completed around 200 years before the Bavli. The Talmud Yerushalmi was finished, this is an approximate date, around 400. And the Talmud Bavli was finished around 600. Obviously, therefore, there are Amoraim in the Bavli that are not in the Yerushalmi because they were later. But there is an overlap. Let's take Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish. Rav Yochanan and Reish Lakish are prominent in both the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. Abaye v'Rava not, because Abaye v'Rava are after the 400 date. So there's a lot of overlap. Keep in mind as well, I'm just giving a little background information, keep in mind as well that there are masechtas for which there's both a Bavli and Yerushalmi. There are masechtas, there's only a Bavli and not a Yerushalmi. And there are masechtas, there's only a Yerushalmi and not a Bavli. For most of Moed, Nashim, and Nezikin, there is both a Bavli and a Yerushalmi. For Seder Zerayim, the laws of agriculture, you will note, of course, that in the Bavli, there's only Maseches Brachos, but there's no Gemara on Peya, Bikurim, Demai, Trumos, Shavias. But there is a Yerushalmi on every single tractate in Seder Zerayim. So in the laws of agriculture, the Yerushalmi is a very, very important source of halacha. Although in the Bavli too, there are many discussions of Mishnayos and Zerayim, but even though it's not on the order of the Mishnah. Now the other way around, where do you have a Maseches in the Yerushalmi, in the Bavli, that you don't have in the Yerushalmi? Now this is counterintuitive. Seder Kodshim, the Masechtas about Korbanos, Zavachim, Menachos. Now there, you might have expected, just like there's Zerayim in Yerushalmi and not Bavli, because Zerayim was mainly Nogea Eretz Yisrael, one might have expected, if there's going to be Kodshim only in one, I would have put it in the Yerushalmi. The answer is no, it's the Bavli that has Kodshim, not the Yerushalmi. Although the Rambam writes in the Hakdama of the Perush of Mishnayos that there was a Yerushalmi on Kodshim, which we don't have, unfortunately. We apparently lost it. And I don't want to be marich too much in digressions, but around 150 years ago, there was a rabbi who claimed to have discovered a long-lost Yerushalmi on Kodshim. Imagine this. And he published it. And he had haskamas of great gedolim. I mean, imagine how exciting that would be if you discovered a lost Gemara, a lost Yerushalmi. But it turned out that he made it up. It turned out that he must be a brilliant person. Imagine the skill that it takes a person to forge a Gemara that could convince some Gedolim. Some Gedolim were actually convinced that this was authentic. But they say the Rugachever was able to expose it, and eventually the guy confessed that he just made it up, etc. So as far as we know, we do not have, and it hasn't been reprinted, although you can actually get it in the HebrewBooks.org, you can actually see what it looks like. So we don't have a Yerushalmi on Kodshim. Now, one would think that the Yerushalmi should be very, very authoritative. And yet, we have a principle in Halacha that when there's a machlokas between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, and there isn't always a machlokas, but when there is a machlokas between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, the halacha is like the Bavli over the Yerushalmi. Of course, if you want to be cynical, one might say, who articulated the principle that if there's a machlokas in the Bavli and the Yerushalmi, the halacha is like the Bavli? Where do we get that principle? This was a principle laid down by the Gaonim of Bavel. Meaning, there were Gaonim in Eretz Yisrael who didn't agree with that particular principle, but be it as it may, the Gaonim of Bavel carried the way. Now, there are two reasons why the Bavli is more authoritative than the Yerushalmi. First of all, principle number one is that within a given tekufa, meaning within the period of Amoraim, the halacha is like the later generation. See, although as between Tanoim and Amoraim, we say the Doros go down, but within a single period, we normally say the halacha is like the later, because the later saw all of the svaras of the earlier, and were able to address them and integrate them. The earlier did not see all of the svaras of the later, so perhaps they would have changed their mind. So since the Bavli either saw the Yerushalmi, or at least saw the arguments and svaras of the Yerushalmi, we apply the rule, halacha kibasroi. Halacha kibasroi means the halacha is like the later authorities. Now again, I mean within a tekufa. In other words, obviously I don't mean an Acharon can argue with a Rishon or an Amora can argue with a Tana, but within that framework, we say halacha kibasroi. That's one reason. The second reason is you have to know a little bit of history, and that is after the writing of the Mishnah, which was around 200, right, for the next 200 years, until the Yerushalmi was compiled, the Jews in Eretz Yisrael were under an extreme persecution. What happened was the Roman Empire converted to Christianity under Constantine, and they were absolutely vicious in almost eradicating the Jewish communities of Eretz Israel. As a result, there was persecution, there was shmad, there was forced conversion. There was what was called tiruf hadas, confusion, inability to focus. And therefore, as opposed to Babel, Babel was not under the Roman domination. Babel was under Persian domination, Sasanian domination. And all the Sasanians were Zoroastrians. They believed in the god of light and darkness. And, you know, they weren't the greatest people in the world, but they kind of let the Jews alone. And that is why Torah flourished in Babel. So, on a simple matter, therefore, the conditions for Torah study and halacha were much better in Babel than they were in Eretz Israel. We don't realize how vulnerable Eretz Israel was at the time. In fact, the community was almost extinguished, down to almost a very, very small number of people. And these are the two reasons why the halacha is like the Bavli. One is the general principle of halacha kebasroi, and the other is that the Yerushalmi was written, and it was a whole period of shas hashmad. Very, very difficult shmad, because you have to remember that it's interesting. The Christians, when Rome was pagan, the Christians were persecuted as well as the Jews, right? But when the Christians, when Rome became Christian, they became much, much worse persecutors than even the pagan Romans were. It's interesting. Paganism was a bit more tolerant of Judaism than was Christianity. Paganism, you believe in 100 gods, so let you be Jews be 101st god, you know, whatever it is. So there were many, many years in which the Romans, you know, let the Jews alone. But once it became Christian, it was fanatical in its persecution against the Jews, and that had a major impact. Now, this also explains why the whole derech of the Talmud Yerushalmi is very different. Again, most of us don't spend a lot of time learning the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi, number one, is even a different Aramaic dialect. The Aramaic is not the same. What is called Palestinian Aramaic is different than Babylonian Aramaic. I mean, it's not totally different, but it's like different dialects. So even if you knew Gemara very, very well, you might find the language of the Yerushalmi unfamiliar. By the way, it's the same Aramaic as Midrashim. The Midrashim also is different than the Aramaic of the Gemara. It's Palestinian Aramaic. But if you'll notice, the Yerushalmi has much less pilpul than the Bavli. In other words, basically it'll have a Mishnah, Kasha, Teretz, next Mishnah. Very rarely do you have the extended Shakla Vitaria. Some understand this because it was really composed under great stress, and therefore they just had to put down very, very brief notes. But there is another Machshava, though, that Rav Kook said. Rav Kook says a very, very beautiful idea. He says that, in fact, the Yerushalmi represents a higher madrega than the Bavli. And he says there are two different ways that one perceives truth. One way we perceive truth is by process of elimination, meaning we consider every other possibility and we say, well, maybe this, no, not that, not that, not that, not that, not that, not that. After you eliminate everything, you then have proof. That's the derech of the Bavli. Think about how a Shakla Vitaria goes in Gemara. We have a contradiction. So we give an answer. But then we say, well, that answer can't be right because that contradicts that. So we have to give another answer. No, but that doesn't fit that. Essentially, what you're doing in Gemara is you're trying to come to an understanding by eliminating everything else. A typical Yerushalmi might say, Kasha, and then give you the final answer without going through all the intermediate steps. Rav Kook points out that the Yerushalmi's MS is not the MS of logical argumentation, but it's intuitive truth. It's the nature of prophecy, the nature of Ruach HaKodesh. Ruach HaKodesh, you just get the answer. In fact, by the way, the Lahavdil, they say there are certain scientists that way. Einstein was a scientist of that nature. That Einstein kind of saw a problem and grasped intuitively how to deal with it. In fact, he had sometimes difficulty in reconstructing his reasoning because he didn't reason in a sequential A, B, C, D step. It's like he just saw it. In fact, people say, those of you that have a physics background, that part of the great difficulty in something like the theories of relativity, special or general, it would have been discovered even without Einstein maybe 10 years later. But had it been discovered 10 years later, it would have been an easier theory to work with because it would have been the outgrowth of logical development. Einstein skipped too many steps, so to speak. He went from A to Z without working out the intermediate premises. He just saw it in the right way, and that made it difficult because then after the fact, physicists have to kind of figure out, well, how do you get there? Rav Kook Tainis, the difficulty we have in the Yerushalmi is the Yerushalmi living in Eretz Yisrael had a direct kesher to intuitive emes, and therefore it doesn't go through the logical shakla vitaria, as opposed to the Babylonian Talmud, which is the product of galus. It has to go through the laborious possibilities. So for us, as hard as Gemara is, the Bavli is easier for us because the Bavli, again, you may not describe Gemara there, but the Bavli is trying, at least with Rashi and the commentaries, is leading you through a process. The Yerushalmi that goes from A to Z without telling you what that process is, and it's much more difficult to follow. And Rav Kook says that was the Maila of Eretz Yisrael, that it was an intuitive, prophetic sense of emes, as opposed to the sequential, logical structures of the Bavli. That is why you'll find, by the way, a similar idea even in Rishaynim and Achrayim. Rishaynim are much more briefer than Achrayim. Achrayim have to go to great, great lengths to spell out everything. And the Gaonim are even shorter. Tshuvas HaGaonim. Someone asks a Shaila, and they may get a one-word answer. Mutter, Usher. That's it. By the time we have Achronim, we're going to write 50, 60 pages on everything. Because as you get further and further from MS, you need to go through more of a process to get it. Otherwise, but when you're in a prophetic mode, you kind of just see the MS without having to work through everything. So this is a difference between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi. I just want to point out that in terms of general sheetahs, there's a very excellent sefer. It's an advanced sefer. It's called Talmud de Marava, because the Yerushalmi is called the Talmud of the West, because Eretz Yisrael was west of Bavel, in which this sefer actually goes through every machlokas between the Bavli and the Yerushalmi and kind of explains it. It's a very, very phenomenal bit of work that a mechaber put forward. One interesting thing, and I'll throw out one thing at random, because there are different things we could say. One interesting thing is that the Bavli has quite a lot of agada regarding shadim, demons, and the like. None of it is in the Yerushalmi. It's very interesting that the idea of shadim and mazikim does not appear in the Talmud Yerushalmi at all. Now, maybe Eretz Yisrael was pure of those things. We don't know. But that would be one interesting nafkamina in approach. Yeah.
As we know, the different communities, the Sephardic, Ashkenazi, and the Hasidic community have different pronunciation of words.
Yeah.
And so I just want to know how exactly did that happen, because we have very strong traditions, and you know, since we have traditions, this shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
And also, what impact does it have on the meaning of the word?
Yeah, this is a very, very difficult question. Hebrew was the Lashon HaKodesh, let's say, was the language that Avraham Avinu spoke, Moshe Rabbeinu spoke, the Jewish people. Presumably they all spoke it one way. And yet in the course of time, we have different pronunciations. And now, how that happens, how it happens is that for various reasons, the pronunciation of the Hebrew language is connected to how the foreign language is pronounced. Meaning to say that in Poland, things got pronounced the way Polish was spoken. You know, in Germany, the way German was spoken, and the like. So in many, many ways, the languages got corrupted by virtue of contact with the vernaculars, and Jews that were raised in different societies picked up different things. That's why it's sometimes not entirely true. People sometimes say that the most authoritative, authentic... If I want to know, how did Moshe Rabbeinu speak Hebrew? So many people say that the Taimani, the Yemenite pronunciation, which is not Sephardic, it's different, is the most authoritative pronunciation historically of Hebrew. For example, they have a W sound. The Vav is actually a Va Yomer. They pronounce it like a W. In other words, they have certain consonants that we don't have in regular Hebrew. On the other hand, even though the Yemenite may be an old pronunciation, there is no doubt that it was also influenced by Arabic. So it's not so pasha that even Yemenite is pure. It got influenced by Arabic pronunciations and the like. And that's why different things. The word Torah, or Torah is the way it should be pronounced. The wrong accent, that's Bechlala. That's not, when I say Shabbos, Torah, that actually is incorrect under every possible Hebrew pronunciation. Shabbos and Torah are not Hebrew words, they're Yiddish words. Now again, that's how we all talk. But technically, you have to pronounce it either Shabbos, if you follow the almost extinct Ashkenazic pronunciation of Hebrew, but it's almost extinct, or Shabbat, and Torah also is Torah, not Torah, because in Hebrew most words are accented in the last syllable, not the first syllable. The first syllable accent is a Yiddish pronunciation, not a Hebrew. Now again, I mean, I talk that way too. I mean, I'm not telling anyone to change, but at least they should be aware of it. So the word Torah can be Torah, Torah, Toira, Oi, Teira, if you're a Litvak, Taura, if you're a German, right? So there's the, it could be A-U, O-Y, could be a pure, you know, A-I, Teira, a Litvak says Teira, not even, right? So it's very, very confusing. Now, the one thing, the good news is that the Psak Halach is very, very clear, although the logic is not so clear to me, but the Psak is very clear, that whatever pronunciation is common within your community is considered a halachically acceptable pronunciation, and you are yotze whether you say Torah or Teira or Toira or Taura. And now why that's so, I'm not sure, because it seems to me, according to basic logic, we should have to pronounce words according to the way they were pronounced. I mean, Mehechi Tesi, that if we change the pronunciation of Hebrew, that should have any validity at all. And yet, the poskim do say that. So you really don't have to worry. But as you recall, for Parsha Socher, which is a Kriyas HaTorah D'Oraisa, we try to have multiple Kriyas HaTorah to correspond to everybody's, not everybody, we can't get everybody, otherwise you have 200 linings, but we try to correspond to basic pronunciations. I think there was were there three readings? There was a Taimani and a Sephardi and an Ashkenazi. Although even with Ashkenazi there are different pronunciations. Now there is a fellow, a Moroccan Rav, who is working very hard on trying to establish the original pronunciation of Hebrew. And he claims that he's done so, and he's actually pushing. He says he understands that for an adult it's almost impossible to change how we read Hebrew. We're used to it. But he's urging that we ought to teach children how to do this, and he has some haskama, so he's actually working on trying to introduce what he says, and I'm not sure if he's proven it 100%, what he says was the way Moshe Rabbeinu spoke Hebrew. But the bottom line is that Lamaisa, we are Yotze, no matter what Havara that we use, as long as it is the Havara that is your Minhag.
I was just wondering, what's the source for the way we pronounce
Shem Hashem?
The way we pronounce it.
The way we say it. Yeah, and those Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. Yeah. Well, the source of that is the following. We said in Parshas Vayera, when Hashem taught Moshe His name, He said, "Zeh Shmi Li'olam." This is my name forever. But the word Li'olam is spelt without a vav, and without a vav, you could read the word la'alem to be concealed. And the Gemara has a drasha that the Shem HaMeforesh is normally not allowed to be pronounced, except in the Beis Hamikdash. In Beis Hamikdash, it was said every day during duchening. When Kohanim duchened in the Beis Hamikdash, not just the Kohen Gadol, people make a mistake. People think the Shem HaMeforesh was only said by the Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur. That is not emes. The Shem HaMeforesh was said twice a day, at least, in the Beis Hamikdash, when every Kohen duchened, not just the Kohen Gadol, and they would say the Shem HaMeforesh. By the way, this isn't your question, but as an aside, how would you pronounce the Shema Mefarish? I want to point out that there's an absolute mistake here, and that is people think the Shema Mefarish is pronounced. The truth is, I actually am allowed to say it, but I'm not going to say it because our minhag is we don't say it. Y-E-H-O-V-A-H. People like the Witnesses, the Christian group, the Witnesses. People think that is the pronunciation of the Shema Mefarish, and that's why we don't say it. The truth is, that is not the pronunciation of the Shema Mefarish, and you are allowed to say it. That is a word that has no meaning at all. Again, so theoretically I could say it, but in case I'm wrong, I don't want to take the consequences. but according to halacha, I don't want to take a chance. But according to halacha, that is not how the Shema Mefarish was pronounced. How was it pronounced? The answer is we don't know. We actually do not know how the Kohanim and the Kohen will pronounce the Shema Mefarish. Okay, but putting that aside, so that only tells me the negative. I don't pronounce the Shema Mefarish. So how do I know to pronounce it the way we pronounce it? So this is interesting. This is something that you have to look at. It all depends on the vowels that are under the Yud-Ke Vav-Ke. And the vowels are not always the same. There are times in which Yud-Ke Vav-Ke is pronounced as Elokim. And if you look, you will see most of the times the Nikud is the same as Aleph, Dalet, Nun, Yud. And sometimes the Nikud will be Elokim. Right? So since the Nikud was given to Moshe B'Sinai, right, the approach, I don't mean the actual picture of the vowel, the particular symbols we use for the vowels where it was invented, that was invented later, but the idea of how you pronounce a word was halacha Moshe B'Sinai. So every single time we had a Mesorah, whether the Yud-Kei Vav-Kei should be pronounced Adnus or Elokim. And that's how we know. And the way we know it in writing is you look at the vowels under it. Now, one thing you might be a little confused. Well, wait a second here. The vowel under the Aleph of Aleph Dalet Nun is a Patach, an A. But when I look at Yud-Kei Vav-Kei, the vowel under the Yud is a Shva, right? So that's not the same vowel. But the answer is it actually is, because technically the patach under the aleph is not just a regular patach, it's a chataf patach, which is a shva. So the shva represents the chataf patach. So, but other than that, the O, right, Yeho, right, that's Ado. Okay, and the kamas under the vav is, right, so you see that if you follow the vowels and take the letters, aleph, dalet, and yod, you'll see that it does fit. That's how we know it. Yeah.
What's the source for having seven aliyahs for each parasha? Also, how do we know why to split them up? Is it kind of arbitrary? Some aliyahs are longer, some are shorter.
Yeah, those are good questions. The first question is straightforward, and that is there's a whole parak in Maseches Megillah on all of the laws of Kriyas HaTorah, Shabbos. We have seven aliyahs, not counting Maftir. Yom Kippur, we have six. Yom Tov, we have five. Rosh Chodesh and Chanukah. I'm sorry, Rosh Chodesh and Chol HaMoed, we have four. Chanukah, we have three. Monday and Thursday, we have three. Shabbos Minchah, we have three. All of this is in the Gemara itself. And obviously, this indicates the hierarchy of holiness, which is actually very, very fascinating. People ask the question, which is holier, Yom Kippur or Shabbos? And people say, well, Yom Kippur is called the Shabbos of Shabboses. And yet, in Kriyas HaTorah, right, Shabbos is seven, Yom Kippur is six, right? It's very interesting that implies Shabbos is a holier status than even Yom Kippur. But putting that aside, the Gemara goes through the different symbols. You know, Shabbos is the source of blessing for the whole week. That's why you have seven, that every single day of the week is blessed because of the Shabbos. There is a machlokas in the Gemara. Is Maftir an extra aliyah, or is Maftir one of the seven? And it's a machlokas, but as you know, of course, our minog is we treat Maftir as a separate aliyah, so practically, therefore, on Shabbos, we have eight aliyahs, but that's because Maftir is an extra aliyah, and in fact, unless it's a special Maftir, Maftir doesn't read anything extra. Maftir just rereads something that was already read. Now, the second question is a little more difficult. Okay. who made those breaks, where you do it, because you can divide it different ways. And in fact, as far as the Gemara is concerned, the Gemara is virtually indifferent where you make the breaks. The Gemara gives you guidelines, and that's about it. The Gemara says, for example, right, if you look in a Sefer Torah, you will see the Torah is divided into paragraphs. Psuchos, some paragraphs are open, meaning they end in the middle of the line, and the rest of the line is blank. And some are stumos, where the next paragraph begins on the same line after a break of nine letters. So the only rules we have in the Gemara, we have a few rules. Number one, we try not to begin or end with something negative. So, you know, if a pasuk says, I will utterly destroy you, you don't end an aliyah there. You don't begin an aliyah there. Right? You keep on going to finish with something good. Another rule, which is very important, is that you don't end within three verses of the end of a paragraph, meaning you end leaving at least three verses to the end, and you also don't end within three psukim of the beginning of a paragraph. Okay? Meaning, once you start a paragraph, you got to read at least three verses, and you have to leave at least three verses. So if you only have a paragraph of less than six verses, you're going to have to read the whole thing and go into the next paragraph. Because if you have a paragraph of six verses or less, there will be no way you could stop any point in that paragraph, even if you read many psukim from before, because you will not, you have to be more than three verses in and three verses from the end. Okay? That's why by Rosh Chodesh, without getting into that, that's why we have to repeat a verse, because we actually don't have enough psukim to meet all those requirements. So insofar as the Gemara is concerned, as long as you follow those guidelines, you know, you can make your seven anywhere you want. There is no halacha regarding how to do it. And that's why occasionally in tikkunim, you know, there will be some disagreements. On the other hand, 90% of the time, we seem to have a standard place. So we really don't know. This is really over the years there were minhagim that got standardized and concretized, but halachically they're not binding. You're not mechuyev to follow those particular minhagim as long as you follow the guidelines of the Gemara about ending and beginning with good things and being sure that you have three verses from the beginning of a paragraph, three verses from the end. Okay. Yeah. Well, again, that's a very, very big question, and the problem is this. The problem is there are many types of chassidus, and there are many types of mussar. So it wouldn't be possible to give you a single difference. There is some types of chassidus that's very close to some types of mussar. But the common, I'm going to have to stop now, maybe we'll talk about this more biarichas, but the common definition that's given, although it's not a complete answer, is that chassidus emphasizes serving Hashem out of doing good and having joy, and Musar perceives of serving Hashem by turning away from evil. David HaMelech said, Sur Meira, turn away from evil, v'yaseh tov, and do good. Musar emphasized the Sur Meira, and the chassidus emphasized the Aseh Tov. So again, this is a simplification, and it really is not completely true, but one of the generalities we use is that chassidus emphasizes the joy in the good that you're doing, and Musar requires the honesty of looking at the negativity that is within your personality. Okay, and that's a common distinction. But as I say, it's a little misleading, because there were certain chassidus like Kutsk that very much focused on that type of introspection. Okay, but again, maybe bring it up next week, and it's something that deserves a longer answer. Be well, and we'll see you tomorrow.